Welcome to the Steve and Dan Podcast. Tonight, Steve and Dan discuss episode 502 of The Walking Dead, Strangers. Okay, hi, I'm Steve.
And I'm Dan, and we're going to talk about Walking Dead Season 5, Episode 2, titled Strangers.
That's right, Episode 502, which is being the second episode of the fifth season of the best show on television. Well, maybe not, but one of my favorites for sure. A couple interesting things about tonight's episode, or last night's episode. Director was David Boyd. Have you ever heard of this guy?
No.
Of course not. Neither have I until today. But he actually directed my favorite episode from last season, which was episode 405 called Internment, which was the Herschel Kicks Ass episode, if you might recall.
Yep.
That's the one where Lizzie dragged her toe in the blood and led off that one zombie, and Glenn was dying, and Carl and Rick went absolutely kick-ass outside as well. So really good episode, and I thought last night's was quite a good one as well.
Right.
A lot of really important story threads coming together. So, and in that vein, actually, interestingly enough, the writer of last night's episode was Robert Kirkman, who is the creator of the comics. And I think they brought him in specifically for this episode because of several tie-ins with characters and storylines from the comics.
As a non-comic reader, Steve, maybe you could clue me in on some of those links.
Perhaps I shall. And let me just say right now for anybody listening, dear listener, there will be some conversation about the comics today. So if you do not want to be spoiled on the comics, please skip those parts. We'll just flag them with a Bob or something like that in between, and then you'll know to skip ahead 5 minutes.
And you should also know that I know nothing about the comics and next to nothing about the TV show.
Okay, so regarding the comics, there is a Father Gabriel in the comics. Mm-hmm. And from what I can see so far, he appears to be played pretty much the same as he is in the comics. You notice when Rick first met him, Rick gives him the ubiquitous Rick's three questions, which are, how many walkers have you killed? How many people have you killed? And why? And what were Father Gabriel's answers? Well, he said zero, zero, and, well, therefore, he didn't have a reason because he hadn't killed anybody. But then Rick, of course, says to him, well, what have you done then? Because everybody's done something. And Gabriel looks really uncomfortable. He tells him, you know, I'm a sinner, but my sins are between me and God.
Yeah, not something that I will say to strangers, which is also tonight's title.
That's true. So here we have the strangers title coming in. And he's the obvious first stranger that we see. But we also have strangers within the group. Tara, who the last time Rick saw her, the last time Maggie saw her before meeting her in the tunnel, where was she?
I presume she was hanging out with the governor, hanging off a tank, shooting rounds at the jail.
Exactly. She wasn't shooting rounds. She freaked out and she hid behind the tank. But yeah, she was there with a gun. And she was thinking it was all a big bluff, right? She didn't realize that the governor was a sociopathic bastard who was going to go and kill everybody because he didn't really care. So she was hiding. She was shocked with Herschel's death. She went into full-on shutdown mode after her girlfriend was shot and she was left alone amongst all the walkers. So yeah, she saved Glenn. Glenn saved her, all hunky-dory. But Rick forgives her, gives her an awkward fist bump, as I put it in my review earlier. They were kind of talking, and he's like, no, you saved Glenn's life, and that's good enough for me. And Rick's like that. Rick is all about, if my friends trust you, I trust you, which is kind of dangerous, actually, a little bit.
Yeah, well, speaking of Rick's trust in other people's judgment, he bases a rather major decision later on in this show in the approval of his one-year-old daughter.
Yes, he does. Oh, what's that? What's that you said? Oh, I guess she wants to go, so I'm coming too. That was an interesting moment. It was this moment of lighthearted jollity amongst the group.
Yeah, it always signals bad news.
Oh, guaranteed. And as we will get to later, we will talk about exactly what kind of bad stuff's happening on two different lines at the same time that little bit's going on. But I guess we should probably do a brief episode synopsis, eh?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so we start with the gang post-Terminus destruction. We do see the smoke in the background, so we know it's still pretty close time-wise, probably within a day of the destruction of Terminus. They hear a sudden noise off to the left, and they all tense and pull out their guns, and of course it's Daryl with his squirrels, because Daryl is hunting squirrels for the gang. He is a hunter for the group, and the word hunter will become very important later on.
Hunter and a tracker. I mean, he hears something, and later on he says that he has the feeling that they've been watched. But then I think he goes and does some of his tracking stuff and comes back finding that there was nothing there at all, which is kind of curious.
It's his background, living in the bush. But he's hunting squirrels for the group. And it's a pretty large group, so it's going to be a lot of squirrels he's going to have to catch. There's 15 of them now.
I could eat like 3 squirrels on my own.
Oh, no, easily. Yeah, they're kind of desperate. They're out in the forest. They hear a noise. They hear somebody yelling for help. No, this is always a bad sign in the zombie apocalypse when you hear somebody yelling for help. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, Carl, who always learns his lessons extremely well, what does he do?
Dad, we got to save that guy.
He immediately starts to take off. Now, fortunately for the group, Wishy-washy Rick suddenly makes an appearance and kind of looks around and doesn't know what to do and then follows Carl. But the whole group goes together, which is good. This is a good sign. You know, in the past, they might have sent off four or five people to find out what was going on, get split up, and then bad things would happen. Mm-hmm. So at least they're kind of sticking together now. And there's Eugene, you know, running with his arms straight down beside his sides, looking extremely uncomfortable and not very, you know, athletic. But they're all making it. They all get there. And there's a big rock with a man dressed as a priest on top. And he's screaming, and he's kind of pushing with his foot at the zombies, the walkers, and not doing a very good job of it, so the team comes in and just takes them out. Bang, bang, bang.
It should be noted, he's sitting on a single exposed boulder in the middle of the forest.
Obviously left behind from the last ice age. Yeah, I mean, it was very convenient that the glaciers made it all the way down to Georgia for him. But yeah, he's sitting there, or kind of scrambling there, I suppose. And they get him off, and that's when Rick, perhaps that's not the best way to put it, they get him off the rock safely, and Rick asks him his three questions, and he says, I'm going to take you to my church. I have a church nearby. Then he makes a really bad joke. What does he say to Rick?
Yeah, he says, well, maybe I'm leading you into a trap. I'm going to go and steal you guys' squirrels.
Yes, and he says, you know, maybe there's a whole bunch of people there waiting for you. And then, of course, nobody laughs, because they've just come from Terminus. And this guy is completely oblivious. He's completely oblivious. How the heck has he survived this long in the zombie apocalypse without having killed a zombie, a walker, or having killed a person to survive? Wearing his priestly outfit that looks pretty well taken care of.
It does seem implausible. However, he was genuinely about to get killed by those four zombies. He was fairly defenseless on top of that rock.
This is true. And this is, as he tells Rick and the gang a little bit later, this is the furthest afield he'd ever gone from the church. He had stayed in the church for basically the last 2 years. The reason being that he was surviving off of the charity of others. They'd had a great big canned food drive right before things went to hell. And so he survived on that basically 2 years worth of canned food sitting in his church.
Mm. Yeah, and the evidence is all there spread out behind his altar. He's got all the open cans. Story kind of checks out in many ways.
Well, it does. It does. Although there are some questionable things about the church later, which come to light when Carl does some investigation. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about that in a bit. The group now splits up. Now, here's the problem. They tend to stick together early on, but they split up, and that's when problems start to happen.
Is this when they go out to find food?
Yeah, so you've got...
Right, so Gabriel brings them in, and he explains that everything has been looted in the area around there, apart from one place that is overrun by zombies. So Rick decides they're going to go and figure it out. Who do they take? They take Michonne, Bob, Sasha, and Rick, and Gabriel. Is that the gang that goes?
And then you've got Glenn, Tara, and Maggie going in another group to a gun store to look for anything they can find that's been left behind. Mm-hmm. Which they find, like, Glenn finds three scopes. That's all he finds inside of a mini fridge.
Yeah, three silencers, right?
Yeah, and it was funny because as he's coming out, there's this bang and a noise, and they both the ladies look really worried for half a second until he walks out, and they say, was it a walker? And his first response is, yeah, it was a walker. Mm-hmm. And they know, actually, I tripped.
Poor Glenn, he's still a geek.
He is. But Maggie loves him, so it's okay. And then the other group is Carol and Daryl.
Carol and Daryl.
We should come up with a nickname for those two. Because they're going to make a cutesy couple at some point, I'm pretty sure. But they go out looking for water, and they come across a car, which is very interesting.
Saying we'll save it for later.
Yeah, in case we need to make a quick exit.
Yeah.
So she's always prepared. She knows that things can go sideways really quickly. And we find out later that maybe there's a little bit more of a motivation behind that. Because she's not very comfortable with the group. As much as she feels happy to have saved them, and she does love them as family, she doesn't feel a part of the group entirely.
Do you think Carol worries that she is still a threat to the group if she stays around them?
Well, she's made the hard choices, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's something that she definitely is worried that if she continues to make the hard choices, it's going to always come back to haunt her. She's going to feel that ongoing guilt. So it might be easier for her just to be off on her own.
All right, so the guys are both, they've got two groups that are split up. One group's gone to the food bank, and the other group's gone to the gun store.
So we get to the food bank, and it's unfortunately there's no food in the food bank, at least not up on the upper floor, eh?
Mm-hmm.
There's clothes, racks and racks of clothes. It's basically a thrift store. So where is the food?
In the rotten basement that has kind of, the rain has bled through from the ceiling and like miraculously corroded the floorboards. Or perhaps the zombies were milling around on the main floor, then they fell into the basement.
Similar to what happened in the first episode last season when the helicopter and the zombies fell in through the floor, through the ceiling of that grocery store.
Yeah, they would have splattered into the ground.
That's right. Well, here you've got one of the best lines of the night. When Bob looks down, I mean, you can see they're all kind of making faces. It's really smelly. And he says, I believe he says, if a sewer could vomit, that's what, or actually, if a sewer could puke, that's what it would smell like.
There's not enough descriptive language in that show, you know? We need people to describe the horror that they're enduring more often.
Really, the end of the episode would have been much more fulfilling if Bob had been describing things as well. But Gareth does a very good description, which we'll get to later. Yes, I said Gareth. If you haven't watched the episode yet, he does come back. He never really left.
God bless him.
Okay, so they decide they got to go down there, and Rick comes up with a plan. They're going to push the shelving units against the walkers and then immobilize them that way and take them out one at a time.
Just for the record, the worst plan I could possibly imagine.
Yeah, let's get ourselves down there into this muck
yeah.
that's filled with putridity and crap, and then we're going to, you know, stumble across an unseen floor with possible things that will make us trip and fall, or maybe bite us, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Which we'll talk about in a second.
Perhaps. Who knows, though?
Who knows? It's
but,
true.
And also, like, they're standing up there in this big, big food bank place, but there's shelving units all over the place. Like, wouldn't you just be getting poles and just jabbing those bastards while they're down the hole?
It would be so simple, yeah. But it did kind of enable a bit of a parallel with the Star Wars trash compactor room. I swear I saw one of the zombies holding up a little communication unit going, R2, R2!
Yeah, I thought exactly the same thing when they were down there, and they were just kind of holding them at bay, and the walls of the shelves were getting closer and closer.
Yeah, very much. I was expecting one of them to hold up a big pole and try and keep the shelves apart, but that did not happen, unfortunately, which would have been a great homage. But they take most of them out, except for this one horn-rimmed glasses lady.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who the actress was that played that particular walker, but she was quite good. She was doing the old head twitch back and forth, like she almost recognized somebody
as
she was walking.
The glasses still being on her face was a nice touch.
It was.
She sort of reminded me of the ghost librarian in Ghostbusters.
Yeah,
you know, the one that turns around and goes, shh, then her face turns. Like, this zombie was kind of halfway in between the human and then the full-on ghost version of that woman.
Very much so. She was, and her skin was nicely sloughing off of her face,
yeah.
which was lovely.
Yeah.
The zombies were very well done.
But you could still tell that she was quite attractive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, she. I actually felt, you know, a bit of a stirring as I was looking at her. But, yeah, she looks at Gabriel, uh-huh. and she starts to corner him, and he just freaks out. He looks at her, and what do we see in his eyes? Not just fear.
No, but recognition, Steve.
Absolutely. He knows her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he kind of limply floats back in the water and hangs out against the wall, bearing
and
his neck.
And he spreads out his arms in supplication.
Yeah.
Have you seen Omega Man with Charlton Heston?
Yeah.
He says very much like that scene where he's up in the tree, like in the crucifix. Right?
Yeah,
he's
exactly.
He's got his arms out, and he's the sacrifice. And he's not fighting back. He's not even trying to run from her. He just gets to the wall and he's like, okay, I guess I'm done.
Mm.
And I think there's also, it looks almost like a sense of guilt in his eyes. Like maybe he should have saved her or should have done something differently. She shouldn't have been here. And we do see later in the episode that he's thumbing a picture of him standing beside a beautiful 40-ish mousy looking woman with horn-rimmed glasses in front of the organ in the church. So she was probably the organist. I'm guessing the organist, but
that's why Gabriel was all keyed up when he saw her.
Yeah, he's not looking like he's gonna do much to save himself, and then along comes Rick.
Yeah, Rick just basically laughs at him.
He grabs her head, smashes it a couple of times. So they kill everybody off, and I'm watching the show, and I actually turned to my wife at this point, and I said, you know, something's gonna happen, because it was just too calm. Mr. Optimistic Bob is all smiley, and then suddenly he pulls a Luke Skywalker and gets pulled under the water. And he's got a new dance partner. There's another walker that was stuck under the water because you can't see through the stuff. It's all full of muck and skin and whatever sloughs off of zombies. And he fights with it for a minute. Sasha comes over. She kills it. She asks Bob, are you okay? And he says, I'm okay now. But he looks pallid.
Mm.
He's absolutely ashen. And
I'm okay now could be read two ways, right? Like, as the line is read in the show, it's read, I'm okay now, you've saved me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my feeling is that he means, well, I'm okay for the time being.
Yes, but probably not for much longer.
No.
And my sense right off the bat was that he was bitten.
Yeah, mine too. Like, as soon as a character goes out of sight and then comes back, the whole exercise seems to have been pointless unless there was some significance. So I figure he's been bit.
Yeah. And this actually coincides with some of his actions later. Now, he's been Mr. Optimism all along. He was playing the, you tell me about a crappy thing about the world and I'll tell you the positive spin on it with Sasha earlier. And then he was having a conversation with Rick, when Rick was getting all depressed about this being the real world and how bad it is. And Bob actually said, no, this is a nightmare and you wake up from nightmares.
Yeah, he says the nightmare will end.
Exactly. Mr. Happy.
Yeah, not just yet, though. In fact, they lay his lines on pretty thick.
They do.
Because later on, before he eventually disappears, he repeats a line that he said earlier when kissing Sasha. He just says, just one more. But then she gives him a kiss and he repeats the line, just one more. with a little bit more sadness in his voice.
It reminds me, there's something that it tickles a memory, that just one more, just one more.
Like the end of Deer Hunter, when the guy just goes one shot.
Oh yeah, just one more, that's the one. That's one shot. Yeah, that was...
Yeah, when De Niro's got Christopher Walken,
yeah.
He's trying to get him back, he's like, you know, hey, remember
me? I'll come with you, just one more, and then he pulls the trigger and that's it. Yeah, that's Russian roulette. Don't play it at home, kids. Don't play it at home. So they get the food, they bring a whole bunch of bins back to the church, everybody's happy. It seems. They start to cook up their baked beans, and I imagine there was squirrel meat probably mixed in. And Abraham makes a rousing speech.
I was confused about this speech because it seemed to me that he'd already made the case for going to DC. Are we still to believe that they haven't actually made a decision about whether they're going there or not?
They haven't. No, in fact, because like when they were picking up the guns and ammunition outside Terminus, there was a bit of tension between he and Rick. And I mean, you got two alpha males here, right? And they're both used to being in leadership positions. There's going to be heads butting regardless. Although the whole team has basically said to Abraham, as they were entering the church, they're like, you know, what Rick does, I do.
Yeah.
And ditto for me, and same for her, and et cetera, et cetera. Even Rosita kind of gave him a look. Earlier, do you remember the first time we met Abraham, and he completely goes to town on that one walker, just smashing it over and over and over again with the butt of his gun?
Yeah.
And he's, like, relishing it. He's laughing. You could just imagine the great big stogie. It's a G.I. Joe moment.
It's kind of weird, because we haven't seen much of him at all. He's been the strong silent type ever since.
Oh, for sure. And it was like the establishing shot, right? That was what we first saw him as.
Yeah.
And then that hasn't been the Abraham we've been seeing.
It's kind of disappointing. Honestly, he's been kind of muted ever since he's been introduced. I mean, he did that and he had that scrap with Glenn. But you'd think he's being quiet because he's new to this group of people. But you would expect, as a viewer, a little bit more color from him.
You think so, yeah. I think we'll see color from him, actually. I suspect that we're going to get to see a lot more of Abraham in the next little while.
Yeah.
But
one of the problems is we've just got too many characters now altogether.
Well, we do. They're going to have to kill some people off, I think. One of the interesting things that did happen last night, and this is kind of a parallel to his earlier destruction of that zombie's head back at the end of last season.
Mm-hmm.
Michonne says she'll take out this one walker that's coming towards them, and she reaches for her sword and realizes, of course, she doesn't have her sword, which leads to an interesting conversation later between her and Rick. But she pulls out her gun, or she has like the rifle in her arms, and she starts smashing the zombie to the head with the butt. And she doesn't take any pleasure. She's not smiling. She's not laughing. She's just doing what needs to be done. But then Abraham walks by, and he kind of leans into Rosita, and he says, "Right there is why we're waiting for our moment." So what moment is he talking about?
In the context of what happens later, I presume that he was talking about to give a speech to make their case. But do you have a different idea?
Well, the thing is, it doesn't make any sense in the context of Michonne going to town on a walker. Unless the waiting for a moment means we need these people, because look how efficient she is.
Mm-hmm.
Except that he looks worried when he says it,
yeah.
Which says to me he doesn't like the way she's going about doing the job she needs to do. Maybe, but he's not Tyrese. He's not Mr. Passive. You know, he's not Father Gabriel, never killed a walker. So it confused me a little bit. It was just one of those moments where I think there may have been some other idea that Kirkman had when he was writing the script, and maybe a line or two got cut.
You're a comic reader, you know full well what you're hinting at now, right?
That I'm hitting something. Oh no, I actually, in this case, I'm not.
You're not there?
Like in the comics, Abraham's an absolute badass, like all the way through. There's no question there.
Uh-huh.
So is Michonne. You know, they have a mutual badassery respect for each other. I don't know. This was something different. The stuff that ties in with the comics have more to do with Father Gabriel and the stuff that we see, the hints about him, as well as what happens at the very end of the episode,
right,
with Gareth. But, Abraham is a character in the comics, absolutely. And so are Rosita and Eugene, and they have very specific roles to play.
Right.
And so far, they seem to be playing them pretty true to form, except for that line, which kind of threw me off a little bit.
Although Rosita sort of smiles, not in a conniving way, but almost in an amused way once he says that line.
Almost like, oh, Abraham.
Yeah,
you know.
You're always joking about the people we're going to betray and slaughter.
Exactly.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, terrible evil was. Mm.
I don't know if you today Michonne's diversifying in terms of her murder weapon, but later on she uses one of the most original murder weapons we've seen in the whole show.
The egg beater.
Yeah, she pulls out the whisk attachment from a hand blender.
Yep. And she puts her hand into rotation mode and starts to whisk the zombie's
brings
brains.
The zombie's brains to a froth with peaks.
It was wonderful. Yeah. Well, the Talking Dead afterward, I think his name is Mark Jones. He's an actor. He was one of the guests, and he was talking about how they're using anything now, and he actually picked up the pillow off the couch. I'll kill a zombie with this.
Yeah, the zombies seem to be alternatively extremely soft and extremely hard, depending on what the script demands.
Well, those ones there, they were waterlogged. So, I mean, you could see as they were being punctured, the just the goop and the water and everything was just kind of pouring out. They were ready to burst.
Yeah, their blood was all blue and green. And
it's like the one that was in the well at Herschel's farm.
Yeah, just like that one. They looked like, you know, in RoboCop when that bad guy gets covered on all the acid.
In fact, that's a really interesting point you make because... again, during the Talking Dead episode after The Walking Dead last night, they mentioned that Nicotero had done that as an homage to RoboCop.
Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely.
I haven't seen that show, man. I'm just brilliant.
Yeah, you are. You are brilliant. Michonne, we mentioned Michonne and her egg beater. I don't think it's going to replace the sword.
No. She said she misses the sword, right?
Well, no, she says she doesn't.
She doesn't.
Rick actually asked her, do you miss the sword? And she said it wasn't mine to begin with.
Oh.
And now this is an interesting kind of, if you love something, set it free. She starts telling him, that she goes into this long list of things that she misses. And the things that she misses are the people in the group. Yeah, she doesn't miss anything from before.
No, well, this is actually a theme that's come up, though. Remember when, I forget, the guy that Tyrese is beating up, Martin?
Yes, Martin.
Yeah, that's something he said as well. He was talking last time about how he used to have a life. He used to remember going to church and stuff like that. But their orienting memories now seem to be post-apocalyptic rather than pre-apocalyptic. Like they have a history post-apocalypse that's sort of informing their characters as they go forward.
Not just her then, it's Martin and others. They don't miss the past because what's the point? If you're looking at a past that you can no longer have, it's like in our pre-discussion, we were talking a little bit about Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which I know you're going to be talking about later, but there's this one scene in that book and in the movie where the father takes the son to his house. And he's showing him where the Christmas stockings were hung. He's showing him the piano that he played. And the son's just looking at him like, you're an alien. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That world doesn't exist. It never has existed. It never will exist. And that's basically what they're saying here is, yeah, we lived in that world, but there's no point in even thinking about it. It's gone.
Yeah, the most post-apocalyptic stories are kind of about that moment. I mean, your life is defined sort of by what you've lost in the post-apocalyptic scenario. It's all about rebuilding things, and that comes up in this show too, right? The point of them going to DC is they're going to try and put things back the way they were. Obviously not exactly the way they were. there's going to be some cleanup that needs to be done. But going back. But what else would motivate you? Because, I mean, the point is made later on when they're in the church. I think it's Abraham saying, yeah, you can get up tomorrow, kill some zombies, you're pretty good at it. But he's kind of like, we need a higher purpose, a higher calling. There has to be something to do. And he's chosen, obviously, going to DC, trying to save the world, turn things back. But what other kind of motivations can someone have in the post-apocalyptic world?
Well, I mean, you had Herschel at his farm, and that was his motivation was family and community, right?
Yeah.
Trying to maintain that. You had the group at the prison, and I think their motivation there was trying to create normalcy. A sense of normalcy.
Mm-hmm.
Even Woodbury, even the governor, what he was doing, as crazy as he was, he still tried to create a normal little mid-American town.
Yeah, small town America.
Trying to recapture a lost time. We don't have small town America today, let alone, you know, trying to recreate it in the zombie apocalypse. There is no such thing as small town America. You go down to any small town and you're going to find like closed shops. You're going to find dead streets. It's just not what it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And that's what Woodbury was an attempt to recapture kind of this, you know what Woodbury was?
What?
It was Main Street USA at Disneyland. That's what it was.
So what you're arguing effectively is that metaphorically speaking, the zombies are strip malls and the decline of the downtown.
Yes, actually it's all about the fall of the American dream. Interestingly enough, the comic itself came out before the recession that hit at the very end of the Bush years.
Right, 2008, 2007.
But this show became a TV program the year after that recession hit. So I think that it's definitely part of the theming.
You can't help but be resonant because there's a certain post-apocalyptic sense to today's politics. Do you see many signs that the show is really riffing on that? I mean, whenever you have a monster in a show that eats people, you get a lot of kind of stereotypes and interpretation about capitalism and that kind of thing. Do you see anything like that in Walking Dead, or do you think it's just coincidental?
No, I think that's definitely part of it. Anytime that you get... go back to things like War of the Worlds. If we're going to talk about earlier science fiction,
mm-hmm.
What was War of the Worlds all about? War of the Worlds was all about Britain's fear of being invaded from the continent. So you've got these situations where what's happening in the general culture gets mirrored in the fiction. What was science fiction in the 1950s and 60s all about? It was about the alien other. It was about the fear of communism, right? That's really what the science fiction of the 50s and 60s was about. So if we've got zombie fiction nowadays, which obviously comes first off out of Revelations,
mm-hmm.
like we've got this sense of the dead rising and, not sitting in the ground and bones coming back to bones. We've actually got several Bible quotes that, Father Gabriel has up on his wall, on his board.
Right, which
we'll
talk
about a little bit later. We can talk about those right now, actually.
We might as well, yeah. So, Steve, you went and looked at all of the passages that were cited on the kind of the prayer tablets in the corner of the church.
That's right. There's five of them, and they're all relevant to the large missive that's over the chapel that says, "He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life." And they're all related to that, the idea of eternal life and resurrection.
And cannibalism.
Coming back from the dead. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, cannibalism is a big part of Christianity in the sense of the transmogrification or what...
Transubstantiation. Or consubstantiation, if you're more into the interpretive slap.
Ooh, yes, big words. I'll have to look those up later. I do remember transubstantiation from my friend's Roman Catholic youth group when I was a child. I actually was brought up Anglican, but we didn't believe in the actual transubstantiation of the...
No. Well, Gabriel actually says, though, he says when he's swigging from the wine bowl, and they say there's no one to take communion, and he says it's not communion if there's no one here.
Not just that, he says that until he transforms the wine, it's still just wine.
Yeah, it's still just wine, right? Like in transubstantiation, you know, the belief is that the bread and the wine turn literally into the body and blood of the host, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the five verses we have, I'll read them in order,
okay.
And then we'll just talk about them briefly. Romans 6:4, we were therefore buried with him through baptism into death in order that, just as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, we too may live a new life. Then Ezekiel 37:7, so I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. Then there's Matthew 27:52. The tombs broke open, and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. Then there's Revelations 9:6. During those days men will seek death, but will not find it. They will long to die, but death will elude them. And the last one is Luke 24:5. In their fright the women bowed down with their faces to the ground, but the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead?"
Hmm.
So we've got this, obviously thematically they're all tied in with this idea of the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
With the Christian... ethos, or the idea of the resurrection of Christ, the idea of the end times when the dead will walk the earth again. It's all tied together.
Right.
And so,
the selection of those verses, they could have just, the show guys could have just tasked an intern with finding five quotes on the Bible that sound vaguely zombie-ish.
Which is probably what they did.
Which is probably what they did. Although there are certain sort of resonances in there with this particular episode, do you think that they tell a story? Like, do you think the selection is actually making specific points about the plot, even in the order that they're delivered? Or do you think it's just a general mood thing?
Well, it does definitely have a mood aspect to it. But I think, like, for example, the Luke 24:5, the idea of looking for the living among the dead, this represents Carol walking amongst the dead when she came into Terminus. If they were looking for the living among the dead, they might not have been killed. They're also looking for food amongst the dead in the basement of the food bank, which is looking for what will give them life, therefore the living amongst the dead again.
And food amongst the dead is obviously a cannibalistic theme too.
This is true, which ties in very well.
And the verse that says they will long for death but they will not find it.
Yeah, and
that's got a huge resonance with Bob's situation, because presumably he'd be quite keen to for his own demise anytime now.
Depending on whether or not he actually got bitten, and what happens to him at the end. He's definitely been bitten.
He's been bitten
several times.
Yeah, he's been chewed.
Yeah, they've been chewing on things, pondering Bob, as it were. Poor Bob. We were just talking, it was kind of interesting, because just for those people who are listening, last week before we started our podcast, Dan and I were discussing, you know, what's the point of Bob?
Yeah.
Suddenly Bob has a point.
It's kind of weird, because I forget the actor's name now, but he played D'Angelo Barksdale in The Wire. And actually showed a lot of sensitivity, like really kind of quite skilled actor, very sympathetic. And not much of that came through in his depiction of Bob. Like, he's always felt a little bit two-dimensional, even when he got his own drunk montage, like a couple of seasons, last season.
Like in episode 2 or 3, when Daryl did the... beast mode on him, yeah.
He's always felt like a casualty waiting to happen.
His name is Lawrence Gilliard Jr.
Right,
And he's been around for quite a while now. He was in Gangs of New York way back.
And ironically, replaced, if you liked, in last night's episode by another actor from The Wire.
Which is the minister, right?
Yeah. I mean, Bob's not dead yet, and I don't know if he does die in the near future. I mean, he might survive till the end of the show. It doesn't seem likely.
I have no idea based on the comics, I got to say, because like you did a bit of research yourself, and who is Bob in the comic?
Bob in the comic, I just glanced at a picture. Literally, he's like some 49-year-old white guy who was in the army. But other than that, I don't know anything about him. But it certainly doesn't seem to resemble Bob in the show.
They borrowed a name and they created a new character, basically.
Yeah, I mean, him being a medic was about it.
I mean, well, most of the characters in the comics are completely different. Carol's not alive in the comics. I'm sorry. Okay, there, oops, spoiler. But her character in the comics is this horribly conflicted, suicidal, just wreck of a person. And she never overcomes that. Whereas they started Carol kind of going down that route, especially after she lost her daughter. But then she found the strength within herself to become a much better person and a much more dangerous person, really. Yeah. A survivor, right? So yeah, we see a lot of changes from the comics.
And the leader, in a way. Remember, Rick reframes the eviction of Carol from the group as a kind of coming of age thing and says, you know, it's not, you're not rejoining the group, we're rejoining you. Can we follow
you? And he asks her permission. He says, can we join you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's like, yep. You know, she doesn't say yep, she nods.
Further in that motif of lost mentors or finding new mentors that was beginning the last episode.
It's two things. I think you're right. There's probably some intern was tasked with going and doing searches on Bible verses that are related to resurrection. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it is just part of the way that this show rises above a lot of its competition in that they have these little details. Like when I saw the boards up in the church, I knew that each of those verses would have some meaning. So that's why I went and did the research. Interestingly, that whole church, the whole scene, they actually built that from scratch, eh? They didn't have a church that they wanted to use. And so they actually built that church from scratch. It took 6 weeks to build. But inside and out, the whole thing was done just for this show. So everything's very specific.
You get the sense that it's quite a sizable town.
Definitely. Even having a food bank that big would make for... You must have like probably 50 to 60,000 people in a town that size. So yeah, if you've got that many people around, how many zombies are still around and how has the minister managed to stay safe? He's not that far away. He said that he's been into the town himself to get things from every building except for that building.
Yeah. Well, while they go out foraging to the gun store and to the food bank and... Durrell and Curl go off and do whatever they're doing.
Durrell and Curl.
Carl is hanging around outside being like a sleuth, figuring things out, and he finds all these strange etched markings. He finds like knife marks where he thinks someone has been trying to get into the church. So I just figured that maybe Gabriel's secret is he just kind of locked a bunch of people out and just let them all get killed.
That's certainly possible.
And they were just trying to get in and then they were overcome by zombies or whatever. Or
that would also explain his sense of the guilt in his eyes when he's looking at the horn-rimmed glasses lady.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, or he even forcibly evicted them or something cold-blooded like that. But then we see these marks etched in trees. They don't seem to be much in the way of signs. They're just these sort of horizontal knife marks. I didn't read too much into it, but the camera pans across them a few times.
Personally, like based on the fact that Bob is standing right beside one of those trees with a notch when he is attacked later in the episode, I think it's what the people watching the church are using as markers. These are the trees that we're watching from. These are our spots that we're watching from.
Hmm.
I think it's symbols or signals to each other. Like this is a watch point. This is a watch point.
Hmm.
I could be wrong, but in the preview for next week's episode that they had at the very end of the episode, they did actually show Sasha walking through the woods, and she walks by a tree that's got the same etch mark. So I think that there's something definitely going on. I think there is meaning to it.
I just want to tie this back into Gabriel as well. We've been real geeks this week, Steve. You've done all this Bible research, but I also looked up on the character of Gabriel, because whenever they give someone a name like that, it's usually loaded. Particularly in a show like Walking Dead that doesn't really mind kind of laying on the symbolism. So I was looking up Gabriel's significance, and you know, in the general sort of Christian mythology, Gabriel's seen as the messenger, but he's also a key figure in the Book of Enoch, which is an ancient Jewish text.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this verse from it that seems to be totally relevant. Gabriel is given a command by the Lord, and the command is this: proceed against the bastards and the reprobates and against the children of fornication, and destroy the children of the Watchers. Send them one against another, that they may destroy each other in battle.
Ooh.
Juicy, huh?
Yeah, no kidding. Something of an instigator character, then.
Yeah, and who is also opposed to fornicators. And, you know, at the beginning of today's show, there was a lot of as close to fornication as we get in this show.
Lots of pairings.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of Bob licking Sasha's face.
And Tyrese smiling. You're like, really, dude? That's
yeah,
your sister.
Tyrese is like, yeah, I approve of that.
Yeah, totally.
He's about as cowed as you can get. He's basically a eunuch now, right?
He's emasculated, fully emasculated.
He is. I mean, he acts when he needs to, and he's got that power, right? But, I mean, as we've seen, he failed to dispose of Martin. When they're in the church and everyone's grinning at little cute baby Judith, he's like, anytime you need a babysitter, that's me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Any excuse to hang out with the babies, you know, eat tater tots, watch some daytime TV.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I don't know that... there's basically kind of a gender reversal between he and Carol, which Chad Coleman, who plays Tyrese, did talk about a little bit last night on Talking Dead as well.
Mm-hmm.
Although he was trying to be careful. He's like, can I talk about gender reversals? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. It's fine. This is to say that only women stay home to look after kids. And of course, that's not the fact. You know, that's not the case.
No.
A lot of men stay home and look after the kids too. I mean, you and I, both with our jobs, we end up spending probably just as much time as our wives do with our children.
Yeah, more so, yeah.
If not more. So I'm certainly not judging Tyrese for being a nurturer. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, no. I mean, but it shows like this. I mean, they acknowledge popular perception of traditional gender roles. It doesn't necessarily mean they endorse them.
No, and as we talked about a bit last week, in the comic books, Tyrese is just the badass MF with the hammer. You know, yeah. He goes around destroying.
And he's built. Look at walkers. Him. He's like, you know, the possible exception of Abraham, he looks like the handiest person there.
He could lift a draft horse on his back. Yeah. He's got that kind of strength.
And yeah, he still has absolutely. That hammer in his belt, which is pretty badass.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, he will carry that, and he will probably use it again. Yeah, there will be situations where he will have to pull it out for sure. So, yeah, Gabriel is an interesting character. Then definitely... definitely some allusions there with the name, along with the allusions with the chapter and verse boards. We've got a whole bunch of stuff going on symbolically. Then what do we see? The words. What words does Carl find etched into the side of the church near the window that's been scratched?
You will burn for this, I believe.
You will burn for this. So that's I never heard a clearer accusation than that.
So do we presume that's directed at Gabriel by someone?
I would say so. I mean, yeah. He's been locked up inside the church for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
Or thereabouts, and that would be directed at him. Yes. So he's done something that people have judged him for and feel he deserves to burn in hell for.
Makes me wonder why the person etching that didn't just set fire to the church.
Yeah, I know there's a whole bunch of questions to be asked there. Why didn't they? And how could you not break in? Seriously, if you're a human being with the ability to use tools, you can get a crowbar and pry off some of the boards that are locking up the windows.
Yeah, you can't ask too many questions.
Along those lines, not being able to read too much into anything or having to suspend disbelief, we also have what happens at the very end of the show. And you've got Bob, who was Mr. Optimism earlier, suddenly looking very sad. Now, we figure he probably got bitten in the food bank, right?
It seems very likely.
So he's now at the church, and everybody's super happy eating their baked beans and joking, and Abraham does his big speech that we were talking about, which Rick conveniently looks to Judith for confirmation that they're going to now go to DC, which is kind of funny, cutesy, and you know things are going to go bad. Bob sneaks outside, and he stands at this tree, and he looks back at the church, and he starts to cry. This says to me he was definitely bitten. He's mm-hmm. going out to die. He's decided he can't let them see him turn, and he's just going to go deal with it himself. He's going to go end himself. But he doesn't have a chance, eh?
It's that or that they were all drinking in that church and his sponsor said he shouldn't be around things like that.
That's possible, too. That's definitely a possibility. Although I think his sponsor is probably... He's probably not reporting to his sponsor anymore at this point. But he gets whacked in the back of the head. He's standing by this tree and we see that that notch in the tree that we were mentioning earlier.
Yeah.
And he gets knocked out from behind by a man wearing a hoodie.
By a hooded figure. With three sightings of a hooded figure so far. Earlier on in today's episode, the person who walked across Daryl's vision seemed to be hooded.
Mm-hmm.
But also Morgan at the end of last week's episode.
So initially it looks like maybe it's Morgan. Maybe he isn't as sane as we thought.
And Morgan doesn't know Bob, so you wouldn't necessarily suspect Morgan's motives if he was the one knocking Bob out.
And the first time we met Morgan, his son was knocking Rick out, so there you go. There's a parallel there as well. Unfortunately for Bob, it's not Morgan.
No.
So Bob sort of starts coming to, all groggy, again reminiscent of that scene where Rick was being dragged into the abattoir, where he's kind of in focus, out of focus. And the face in front of him is...
It's Gareth, or Garrett, as some people say. I'm sticking with Gareth.
Yeah, well, I think Gareth is the American pronunciation, so you could show your new chops, your North American chops here, and use the American pronunciation, Garrett. I suppose. But he's sitting there, he's chawing down on something, he's enjoying his dinner. There's a barbecue pit in behind him, and there's about maybe five other termites still alive with him, including our friend Martin, that Tyrese told Carol he'd taken care of last week.
Yeah, he seems like he's taken care of him, right?
He doesn't even look bruised.
Doesn't have a black eye.
Yeah, it's kind of...
He probably just made him pinky swear.
Absolutely. You know, I'll just let you live here if you let me go. Okay. So he's sitting there, they're all eating, and Bob's kind of groggy, and he's looking around, and Gareth has some fantastic lines in this particular scene.
Mm-hmm.
He explains to Bob that they didn't really want to hurt them, but that you and your people took away our home, and so there are certain repercussions. And now he uses this line: "We've devolved into hunters."
He says, first of all, we evolved.
Yeah.
He says we evolved into something, but devolved into hunters.
Terminus was the evolutionary step, right?
Yeah. Yeah, like the evolutionary in terms of they've moved onto a higher state of consciousness. So mentally they've evolved, but in terms of their mannerisms and activities, they've very much devolved.
And he uses the term hunters, which for anybody who's a reader of the comics, that's a huge keyword. And the fact that Kirkman himself wrote this episode means he's not using that word accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
There is a group in the comics who are called the Hunters. And last season, when we had the Claimers, which was the group Daryl was with, and then the Termites, which obviously is where Gareth was, a lot of people were speculating that those two were kind of aspects of the Hunters, but they were split up into two groups.
Right.
Now we see that, in fact, they intend to use the Hunters probably very much like they were used in the comic book. A similar scene to what happens here happens in the comic. So you've got Bob lying there, sitting up against a post.
Shot from the waist up for the time being.
Oh, yes. We're not revealing anything below the waist for no particular reason. What's cooking?
It's shish kebab.
It's shish kebab. That's right. It's a barbecue. they pan back. Gareth says, a man's got to eat. And we see that Bob's left leg is gone from just above the knee. And then we pan over to the fire pit and we see Bob's foot.
Yeah, it looks like he's burning.
Yeah, I think that they basically overdone Bob. But the piece that Gareth's eating is quite juicy. He's actually got like grease on his fingers and grease on his chin, which is just a really lovely touch.
Yeah. I can't help but feeling they were being wasteful. This is the South. They have pig's feet recipes. Surely they could have done something with Bob's feet.
I agree.
If you're going to go to all that hassle of destroying someone, you know, you have to respect the whole animal. You need to make use of it.
You know, they could have turned his toenails into weapons or something. I don't know what they could have done, but
they're yet to fully evolve culinary manners. That's all I'm saying.
I agree. I mean, even stewing it for like a nice base for a soup or something would be more useful than what they do. This builds right into the "he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life." This is kind of the mentality of the group that Gareth's with, that they get strength through eating their enemies. It's a very old tribal tradition from a lot of different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here on the west coast of Canada and the States, where tribes would eat the hearts of the warriors, the enemies. The idea in some other countries, other groups, where people would eat their enemies to gain their strength. It's just a long-standing tradition, and it's just a continuation. And the devolution is a return to a more primal route in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. And now, Pac-Man, too, who eats the power pills that would steal from the souls of dead ghosts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So who are the ghosts in this particular imagery you're building? I don't think that metaphor is going
anywhere. My metaphor is yet to evolve.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got Gareth and his gang, and they're back in town, and they followed, obviously, Rick and the others, and they are planning on hunting them. That's what they're going to be doing. Bob is their first victim. Now, off to one side, we have somebody trying to leave the group for other reasons.
We get, we catch up with Daryl and Curl. Well, just Curl on her own, who has gone back to the car that they decided to set aside in case it was useful later. It seems that Carol might have had uses for it in mind all along, because she's gone there on her own, and she looks to be in the process of getting that thing started up.
And she does. She gets it started.
And then who looms out of the bushes but Daryl to confront her.
And this is a theme we've seen with Daryl throughout the episode, where he will suddenly show up and surprise people.
Yeah.
He did this with the squirrels at the beginning. He does this with Carol now. He did it earlier in the bush. He's an extremely good tracker, and he's also a hunter. But what does he hunt? Squirrels. And Carol, apparently. But as opposed to the ones who call themselves hunters, who are hunting Bobs. So she starts the car. Daryl's like, what are you doing? And then they have a surprise. They hear in the distance, approaching quickly, a car, another car. And it shoots down the road past them. But what's in the back window?
That telltale kind of cross insignia.
Exactly. The one that we saw in the car that took Beth. And Daryl does not hesitate. This is one of the things I love about Daryl. When he sees something needs to be done, he just does it in the moment. He smashes out the lights on the car, which seems counterintuitive at first, because how are you going to see at night?
He needs to sneak up on these guys.
Exactly. So he jumps into the driver's seat, and Carol, who was all ready to leave, is like, what are you doing? She's kind of freaked out a little bit by his sudden action, and he's like, we got to go get Beth.
Yeah.
And so they're gone. They're going to go look for Beth. So we've got the group split into three, kind of. Four, if you count Beth. And I think that next episode is going to be all about trying to figure out what happened to the three people that were with them up until a few minutes ago, basically.
We get a preview of Rick saying, and now three of us are gone.
Exactly. So they're going to count, they're going to think that the hunters have taken not just Bob, but they've also taken Daryl and Carol.
Okay.
So that's going to get them. I mean, Daryl and Carol are two key members of the group. And as much as Bob has been with the group now for a year, or probably, well, for a whole season anyhow, I don't think he's ever really been part of the main group. He's kind of been external, kind of on the outside a little bit.
Yeah.
Obviously more part of the group than Abraham and co. or Tara, mm-hmm. but still kind of a secondary group member.
Now he's very much part of the Termites.
He certainly is. He's making them stronger.
So Gareth says that line, he delivers that line, you are much tastier than we thought you'd be. any theories as to why he might be tasty? Because I've got a couple, Steve.
Okay, you go for it.
Well, the first one is he's been walking around for a long time, so clearly Bob is free range. as his recent interludes with Sasha have shown, he's also quite a tender man.
Oh, okay, that's bad.
And if his backstory is anything to go by, he has been substantially marinated in brandy.
This is true. You know, I've had some of the finest scotches I've ever had were put into brandy casks while they were being aged, and that does make for a fine full-bodied flavor.
Which of the other characters do you think would be delicious?
Oh, gosh. Carl's quite young, so he'd probably be a bit more tender than the others.
Yeah, I think Gareth would definitely eat Judith if he got the chance.
Oh, yeah, guaranteed. Michonne, I think she'd be too stringy, because she's all wiry, right? She's too strong. Rick, there's not an ounce of meat on his bones, so he'd be kind of... He would be very tasty. Father Gabriel, as far as the new people, he'd be very tasty.
Yeah, Father Gabriel would be. He's never used those muscles, you know?
Exactly.
He's like those veal calves that just get massaged for years and years.
They'd have the marbling. He'd have a lot of marbling, yeah. And actually, so would Abraham. He's got the muscles, but he's also got the fat, so he'd have really nice flavor. He'd render up well, actually.
Yeah, I'd feel like he has a really thick skin.
Yeah. We get great crackling off of him.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we should come up with some recipes.
Yeah, Eugene's too weird. Eugene now strikes me as an android.
I'd be worried about getting prion poisoning from eating him. I think there's just far too many brain cells floating around in that man's body.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly from the way he talks.
All right, well, so...
I'm suddenly feeling rather peckish. It did look tasty. It looked good.
It looked really good. It looked really lamb. It had like a crust on it. Yeah, so, but just going back to that scene. So Bob's sitting there with his leg cut off. That kind of reminded me of The Road. We were talking about it earlier. But a similar kind of thing happens in The Road. Sorry,
the livestock in the basement. That's
spoilers
right.
Spoilers and everything. But The Road, both in the book and in the movie, there's cannibalism there. It's a different sort of a post-apocalyptic scenario. It seems like just the Earth's ecosystem has collapsed.
In the movie, in the book, it's pretty clearly a nuclear war.
Oh, you think so? You see, after having read the book, I didn't even get it from the book.
Well, from the book, it's one of either. Like, the thing is, it happens. There were flashes in the dark. The clock stopped at 9. I mean, there were very specific things that stopped, right?
Yeah, which it looks like EMP. A nuclear winter, but there's just, I didn't fully put 2 and 2 together.
McCarthy never tells you, and the reason he does that is he wants you to be able to fill in the blanks.
I guess
Like it could be just like the same reason he doesn't give the father or the son names.
Just the man and the boy.
Exactly.
In The Road, there is a kind of gruesome scene, and it's just the same in the book, really, when there's a cellar. And there are a group of captives who are in various stages of dismemberment, who are being kept as a kind of a living larder. They're not patched up like Bobby's, they're just kind of left to bleed and fester. But it seems like the Termites have done a pretty good job searing, cauterizing, and resealing Bob for later.
Yeah, they want to keep him fresh. What they don't know, though, and what I suspect and you suspect, is that Bob has probably been bitten.
That is the question, yeah. Now, so let's just review quickly the biology of the zombies in this show. Everything we know about them, because it's been kind of confusing to me from day one, why and how people can become infected. So how can people, although everyone has the disease, develop the whatever illness it is that it takes to kill them and then turn them into zombies immediately?
To once again suspend disbelief, because I think that there are some plot holes here, to be perfectly honest. Initially, when we first started watching the show, back in season one, the indication was that if you got bit, you would turn. Mm-hmm. We know that the blood from the zombies does not turn you because they're constantly getting their mouths filled with it, as we talked about earlier. Now, if we're talking Resident Evil, even a splatter of blood in the eye can turn you, I believe. Right. Or same with 28 days later, 28 weeks later. It's just even getting touched.
That's not happening here. You could basically eat a zombie and not turn into one.
Exactly. Now, the problem is that when they bite you... that seems to be something that accelerates. You actually physically die from the bite.
I was going to say, it's like the bite doesn't actually have to be anything to do with the zombification process. The bite just seems to kill you.
Mm-hmm. It's like there's a poison in the bite that can't be cured otherwise, perhaps a concentrated Z virus or whatever you want to call it. But everybody has it. We learned that the episode 7 of the first season, when they were at the CDC, that's the, we didn't actually learn it till early in the second season when Rick revealed what the guy at the CDC had told him when he whispered to him. Now, if everybody already has it, you should be able to just eat Bob and it's not going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But the way that the show goes sometimes, this idea that there's sort of a festering poison in Bob's system, maybe that will make his meat dangerous.
Tainted.
Mm-hmm. Which would be wonderful, because what a beautiful piece of cosmic irony. If they're all now infected and going to die from a poison, as opposed to just the fact that they already have the Z virus inside of them, right? Or the Z virus.
Yeah, it's strange, because presumably, over the next episode or so, if Bob lives that long, he's going to quickly begin to develop symptoms of the flu, which would be easy to put down just to him getting an infection from having his leg cut off.
That's true. Yeah, unless he chooses to tell them. Again, there is some resonance here with stuff that happens in the comics. I don't want to get into it, but people who have read the comics, you're nodding and winking with me right now as to what might happen if they follow.
As opposed to blindly staring into the dark like I am.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now the Hunters in the comics are very interesting. They were a 6-comic arc, so it was a fairly substantial story. This is not to say that makes any difference as to how they'll be shown in the show, because Herschel's Farm was like a 2-comic arc, whereas in the show it was a whole season of sitting at a farm watching the windmill spin. It was very long. Yes, I'm bad-mouthing season 2.
This is boring. Let's check what's in that big barn in the middle of the farm.
No. Let's not do that. Herschel's asked us not to go in there, so we shouldn't. Yeah, because we have all the guns and the manpower, but no, we should listen to Herschel. Oh, well, it's all about respect, right? I love Herschel. I miss Herschel. He was a great guy. He became much better in season 3, I have to say. Once he lost his leg, especially, he was way better.
I always found him to be kind of a bore.
Interestingly, just this is going back to the comics for half a second here. In the comics, Herschel never loses a leg. It's actually Dale. Dale loses a leg in the comics. Do you remember Dale from the first 2 seasons? Obviously, the guy with the RV, the guy with the Fisher's hat.
Yeah, constant pained expression on his face.
Absolutely. He was like constipated all the time, especially when he looked at Shane. It was like all of a sudden bowel movement. But he, in the comics, he survived a lot longer. And interestingly enough, he was the character that the Hunters took from the group. And so when he wakes up, he's not just missing one leg, he's missing both legs. So, because he'd already lost one before. So now he is a double amputee sitting there at the Hunters camp. I think that they wanted to give Bob some purpose. So that's why they built up this romance with Sasha really quickly and then threw him to the dogs, to the cannibals.
Yeah. Bob, it looks like Bob's arc is coming to an end pretty soon. But we know he's still alive in the next season, in the next episode. So perhaps he gets the chance for some sort of redemption,
I hope so. He's not an unlikable character, but he has been fairly bland for the most part.
Yeah, he's not. He's just kind of hapless. Like, I've no idea why Sasha would go for him, to be honest.
Baby steps, Bob. Baby steps. Well, he can't do baby steps anymore, mind you.
Well, he's already done the 12-step program.
I think that's a pretty good one. Okay, so the preview that we see in The Talking Dead has Sasha going through the trees looking for Bob. She's shouting for him. And here one of the, it's not the silencer that Glenn found, but I'm assuming it's one of Glenn's finds. It's a night vision scope that she has on her gun. She lifts it up and she's looking through it, and she does see a figure in a hoodie moving through the woods that's been watching her. And then she turns, and of course there's a walker 2 feet in front of her. So that's, that's where that clip ends.
A solitary figure in the woods?
A solitary figure in the woods, yes.
Yeah, so I get the feeling that's probably Morgan.
It could be Morgan, or it could be the Hunters watching them again. The Hunters, if those notches are theirs, then they've got these watch posts around the church, and they are set up to watch, and probably trying to pick them off one at a time. Bob's out by himself, Bob's gone. I see Sasha out by herself. I'm kind of worried that she's going to be gone next, when you see her in the preview.
She's probably out looking for Bob. She's freaking out.
She is. She's saying, Bob, she's in love. She's decided that Mr. Optimism is her future. It's a shame. She's going to be sorely disappointed. Yeah. He's not going to be a very good dancer anymore.
Nope.
It's going to be interesting going forward. I think that we're going to find, I'm suspecting a couple, maybe even 3 episodes are going to focus on the Hunters group, the Gareth group. So probably episodes 3 and 4 anyhow. And then I believe they're going to turn to Beth.
Yeah, she's got to come back at some point, and we're going to see where Carol and Daryl
exactly.
Go.
So you're not going to see Carol and Daryl next week at all, I don't think. And you might not see them for 2 weeks. And then we'll get like the side story where they're off finding Beth. Which
seems the usual MO.
Yeah, absolutely. And that gives everybody a hiatus mid-season so they can go off and have a break and go to comic cons and things like that. Mm-hmm. And you got to be thoughtful for your crew and your cast.
Yeah. So one scene at the end, I think it was in the preview as well, a little bit disconcerting. Gareth seems to me to be a pretty good villain so far.
Yeah.
He looks like a young Steve Jobs. He has the same sort of predatory business acumen that Jobs has. And he's doing some nasty stuff. He's got some good one-liners. He doesn't have a weirdly strained accent the way the governor did that sort of robbed all the plausibility. Although there was this one scene when Gareth is standing in front of a window, I think it
is. With a bunch of walkers.
And there's a bunch of walkers all pressed up against it. And it kind of reminded me of that scene with the governor when he's got all those heads in the glass jars. Oh, you know, yeah. He's like surrounded by these zombies that are pressed up against the glass. And I'm just like, I'm hoping that they don't turn Gareth into this kind of ridiculous cartoonish villain. You know, he needs to remain a little bit real.
Yeah, the next cartoonish villain I suspect is going to be the widely touted and currently being cast character called Negan, who is from the comic books and a lot of people have been talking about. They've admitted that there's a character called Negan going to be coming in.
And, yeah, I've read about him.
So he's going to be an interesting person. He's a conflicted character who is definitely a villain, at least to begin with. I won't tell you if he changes or not, or dies or gets eaten, or if Gareth chomps down on him or anything like that. But, yeah, he's in the comics a caricature, whereas the character Gareth's playing right now, definitely not. And I sure hope they go with that. I hope they keep him serious, because he's much more frightening as a Steve Jobs type bureaucrat. Yeah. Right?
He's definite Silicon Valley. Like, my feeling is his whole plan is just to redirect the group to Cupertino.
Where he has his rendering plant all set up. Oh, it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. A lot of fun talking with you as usual.
Yeah, man.
And, come back next week and listen to our podcast again, please.
Yeah, come back. We like feedback. Anything good, bad, negative, indifferent. Tell us never to make another podcast if that's the way you feel. But otherwise, yeah, tune in again.
Absolutely. And if you want to read my reviews of The Walking Dead and other shows, you can tune in at reviewsbysteve.wordpress.com.
Yeah, do read Steve's reviews. Very comprehensive.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care, mate. Bye-bye.